Welcome to Mind Matters, the podcast where we talk about different things that are happening in mental health world and in our community. I'm so happy to be here with you. My name is Wendy McCarty Van Bemmel, and I'm joined by my co-host today. I have Marielle as
Hello.
Hi. And Gabe to my right.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Dr. Weiss.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Our Mind Matters podcast today is brought to you by La Amistad, Palm Point, University Behavioral Center, and Central Florida Behavioral as well. And today we're going to do a little Q&A with a real doctor.
So they say.
You're legit. Give us a little bit of background about who you are, your credentials. And we'll go from there.
Absolutely. So I'm Dr. Allison Weiss. I'm from Florida, born and raised in South Florida, but now I'm an Orlando convert, I would say. I like it here. Did my training, went to undergrad at University of Florida, went to University of Miami for medical school, decided I wanted to be a psychiatrist, convinced my dad that it was a good career choice, then made my way to Chicago, where I did my adult psychiatry residency at Northwestern. And then I did a child psychiatry fellowship at University of Illinois at Chicago. And then after that, my husband and I decided to come back to Florida. I found a wonderful position at La Amistad 3 years ago, and here I am.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can I ask, what made you want to get into psych?
So I told my parents when I was 11 years old that I wanted to be a doctor, but I didn't know exactly what kind of doctor I wanted to be. And a lot of different things happened in my life. When I was very young, I had I was diagnosed with a learning disability, dyslexia, and also ADHD. And my parents did everything they could to get me the help I needed. And my mom took me out of school twice a week for 3 years from first grade to third grade to get private remediation. And then after that, I was, you know, in the mainstream system. And I think stemming from that experience, once I got into medical school, I was like, I want to help these kids who are like me. I want to help these kids who are, you know, struggling, and they might not think they're good enough or this or that, or, you know, people would call me stupid and it would upset me, and I knew I wasn't, but like, I wanted to help these other kids recognize that too.
Wow. Yeah. Just kind of learning and realizing that your brain was working against you and mm-hmm. how to overcome that.
Absolutely. How I can get my brain to work for me, and what are the things that make my brain special that make me do things that other people can't do?
Oh, I like that. Rather mm-hmm. than a disability and ability.
Absolutely.
How do you do that today? Like when you're working with some of the kids at La Amistad, can you explain a little bit about what your day looks like?
And yeah.
Yeah. And even about like what psychiatry is, right? For those of us who.
Absolutely. So why don't we start with like the basics? So psychiatry, I am a medical doctor. I went to medical school, you know, 4 years of medical school, and then residency. You have, that's to do general psychiatry, and that's typically 4 years. But if you do a child psychiatry fellowship, they let you go a year early to the fellowship because the fellowship is 2 years. So then you need that sort of training. And so at this point, now I prescribe medication. I can do therapy. I've been trained in all of that. So I would like to think of me as like a therapist plus, maybe. I would say that Mariel's probably a better therapist than
she is pretty good.
Yeah. But my main role is to manage medications and to manage or help manage the treatment team when we have individuals at La Amistad. So basically, it's a team effort where everyone makes decisions. But at the end of the day, it's my signature that goes on their discharge papers, let's say. Mm-hmm. So that's why I need to be aware of everything that's happening, and my staff and the therapists are amazing at doing that. But mostly I'm there to help the therapist, to help the patients, to get them on the right medication, to help them succeed. But I will say that I'm a psychiatrist who doesn't like medications, and I try to limit them as much as possible. But unfortunately, with the patient population that we deal with at La Amistad, which is the residential setting, a lot of these kids are severe enough to get to us. So that typically means that they need medication. And oftentimes I have to, you know, put them on some strong things, but ultimately we get really great results. And that's why I keep doing it.
So you were saying you don't like to use medications as often. What do you like to prescribe?
So I don't love medications. I try to limit them as much as possible. I would say that my primary mode that I push is therapy. I really like cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy. Mariel, would you kind of explain what those are?
Yeah. So, you know, there's so many issues right out there. There's so many behaviors that have a pattern, I would say. We also have the individual who's going to be unique, right? Gabe's different than Wendy, than Dr. Weiss. And so as clinicians, we consider the patient, we consider their style of learning, right? Where they come from, their history. We also look at research. So as a therapist, I do what feels natural to me and my style, my personality, right? But what's most important is what we call evidence-based practice. What do my peers dignify as effective intervention based on research and consistency and the same results over and over and over again? And so cognitive behavioral therapy is an example of that. It's been researched forever, right? And it focuses on the cognitions, right? How we think. And then that affects our behaviors, what we do. And we try to improve, the relationship and the quality of our thinking so that our behaviors improve. As a mom, right, hearing a child and adolescent psychiatrist kind of makes me nervous thinking about children getting medications. I barely give my daughter Tylenol.
Absolutely.
So what is it like for a family, for a patient, what does it take? Absolutely. How do we get to the point, right?
Yeah.
Where we...
And just to kind of reframe too, like a lot of the families that are looking at a residential level of care, it's a little different from, hey, Johnny's sitting in class and he's wiggling.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So great point, Wendy.
Recognize that the people that we treat at La Amistad in the residential setting are children who have unfortunately, for one reason or another, not been successful in their other treatment, whether that's outpatient treatment, whether they've been getting like Baker Act in Florida, involuntary hospitalizations, things like that, or just like repeated patterns of just negative behavior or dangerous behaviors. That's what typically gets you to us. And so that's why I say I have to use medications typically in these patients because they're coming to me after they've tried so many other things. But if you come to me and you're saying, I'm struggling or this or that, the first thing that I'm going to tell you is let's find you a really good therapist and let's go from there. After about 6 months of therapy, if you're not getting anywhere with it, then you should see a psychiatrist, do medications, things like that. There are some diagnoses, though, that medications are pretty much what you need to do. So that would be like ADHD. Could you manage without medication? Absolutely. I've done it for a lot of my life. But it's that much harder. Things take longer. You're not as productive. And so I feel like with that diagnosis, it's one that I do jump on medication because the results are immediate. You take that medication in 45 minutes, you can tell if you're going to respond to it, which is amazing. And then it's out of your system by the end of the day. So that's one that I always treat. But other than that, I really do encourage therapy. Family systems therapy is super important.
I agree.
Have family sessions at La Amistad, and that's required. You must do that because that's what these kids need.
Mm-hmm. So as a psychiatrist, doctor, what are you doing, right? What do the medications address?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So to make a complicated thing as easy as I could possibly put it, our medications work on changing the level of different chemicals in your brain. Some of the medications make it harder for those chemicals to work. Some medications make it easier for the chemicals to work. Some medications increase the amount of chemicals in your brain. Some medications decrease the amount of chemicals in your brain. But that's the combination of factors. And even if you went on to, you know, Prozac, let's say, that's a antidepressant. If you went on to the pharmacology, we still don't know the exact mechanism of action. We don't know why it helps people get better. We just know that it does. And we know that that medication works on serotonin in the brain. And it's a SSRI, which is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And so what that means is it prevents serotonin from being taken back up into your neurons. And so serotonin sits in your brain to be used more.
Oh, awesome. Like stagnant water? Sort of.
It's sort of, if you think about like a pinball machine, how the pinballs, if you keep it in the pinball area, it keeps going and bouncing back and forth. But once it goes down to the bottom, it goes away and it's not bouncing anymore. This basically keeps the serotonin bouncing in your brain.
Oh, wow. Longer. Kind of like the little buttons on the side.
Exactly. That's exactly what it does.
I mean, the technical term, but right. Like, yeah.
Exactly. And so that it makes keeps sense. It there a yeah. little longer yeah. before it sort of goes down the drain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can you give us maybe, I'm thinking as a mom,
yeah.
my mom hat on because I am a mom too. Yeah. And I can only imagine like how scary it is to think about allowing someone else to care for my child.
Oh, yeah.
And getting to the point where you're like, you know what? Everything that I'm doing for my kid is not working. Like, yeah. can you talk maybe about a specific or a general case or a family where you're like, it really worked and it was the right decision?
There's this particular kid who I remember from when I was in Chicago who was so depressed. This kid had tried so many different medications. She was actually, there's this medication that's a patch and it's a very old medication. I won't go into details, but like even that was not working. Like there were so many side effects, things like that. And there was this new medication and I could just see how depressed she was, despondent, melancholic, horrible. I ended up trying a new medication, which is called Vibrid. And it's sort of like an SSRI, but a little bit different. And with that, I got her on it. She was on the medication, I would say, about 6 weeks. And I was lucky enough to get to see her throughout that time. It's almost like a light goes off. And like one day she just came in and it was like the cloud wasn't there. Like there was still sadness. There was still stuff going on, but like the energy was different. And that's how you know it works. And I actually experienced that today. I had a patient who I had been trying stuff and we didn't know what to do. And last week I had to add, they were already on an antidepressant. And so I added another medication because the antidepressant wasn't working well enough. It was working a little bit, but not quite well enough. So I added something else. And this week it was like a totally different kid.
That's still awesome. Sad,
but yeah, like
really powerful. Yeah.
Was engaged with me, was
just kind of gave the tools to get a little jump on it.
Yeah. Last week, this kid was suicidal and telling me that they had no reasons to live.
Wow.
This week, the patient was not suicidal and told me that they wanted to live to go to college.
No.
That was big.
Yeah. That's huge. Yeah.
It's got to feel rewarding.
That is rewarding.
Yeah.
I just hope it lasts.
Yeah.
That's a lot of pressure, doctor. Hearing that all day, hearing children say to you, I don't know if I want to be alive. I don't see a future. Nothing's going to help me. I'm hearing voices. I want to just harm myself. How do you do that all day? How do you not need medications for that?
I have a very good therapist.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it's very important that if you are in the mental health field, that you take care of yourself. Self-care is huge for me. I get regular massages. You have to do these things because you can't let that become your life. I have to leave my work at work. If I take it home, it's going to affect my family. It's going to affect my kids. And I don't want that. So I've really had to learn to let it go, leave it at the office. I don't really know how I've been able to do that, but I think I actively push the thoughts out of my brain. Like I actively say like, no, I'm not going to think about this right now. It can wait. They're in a safe place at La Amistad. They are with safe staff. If there's an emergency, they will call me and I have to trust them. And so that a lot of it is just trust in your facility and the people you work with. I think if I was an outpatient psychiatrist and I didn't have anyone working with me, you tell me you're suicidal, I'm sending you to the hospital. This is not something that we can manage.
Outpatient. What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
Outpatient means that like, I'm just your doctor and I see you maybe like between every 2 weeks to twice a year.
You know? Oh, okay. Okay. So not in a hospital setting.
Not in a hospital setting.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the community, one of the things we've seen is a huge increase of children and adolescents who are struggling now.
Absolutely.
I think every time you put on the news, there's a new survey, new study. Have you seen any of these trends?
Absolutely. I think it's hard for me to say trend-wise, though, because we are typically a pretty full facility, especially for the kids. So are we seeing kids that are really ill? Absolutely. In my neighborhood, anecdotally, am I seeing more kids with mental health issues? Absolutely. I think what we're seeing now is, first, we had the pandemic where all of these kids were socially isolated. They were trying to do school. They were overwhelmed. They didn't know what to do. Everyone's at home. It's horrible. Then you throw them back in. They've lost their social skills for a year. Now they don't know how to interact with other kids. They don't know how to work in a regular school setting anymore. They're too scared to ask the teacher a question or go up to them. They just want to type it, things like that. So there's a lot of, like, I think, cultural factors that are affecting this too. And I think some of the biggest things are that these kids are left alone a lot. Not necessarily to fend for themselves or not because their parents are bad parents, but because they want to be on social media and their parents are like, oh, this is okay. You know, it's keeping them occupied. They're talking to their friends, things like that. But it does get to a point where it's too much, where social media can become really negative. Personally, my kids will not be getting social media if I can help it until they're driving. Because I think it's very dangerous and I think it's very scary.
I think also there's a, you know, not to age myself, but, you know, for my generation, it was
your beard does that with the grays.
My generation was, you know, come home by the streetlights before the streetlights come on.
Absolutely.
And now as a father, I don't feel safe having my daughter, you know, go out. That's
so true. I feel the same. The world has changed.
I'm planning on air tagging my kids when
mine has a watch that has GPS.
You have to be able to know. And that's the other scary thing. It's like, well, what do? I want my kid to be able to be connected with me, but I don't necessarily want to give them a smartphone. So I do have some patients whose parents have bought them a iWatch with the cellular service. So it doesn't do as much, but they can still call their parents if they need. So I think that's a good compromise.
Do you think that's like playing a role in our kids nowadays where there is so much influence? There's so much emphasis on that constant dopamine surge of looking at a screen. Yeah. I can tell you, I have a 6-year-old who I have to make him play with his toys.
Yeah.
He wants to be on that screen.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if that's good or bad. I think we're changing and we're evolving, which we've done from the beginning of time, which is interesting to kind of look at.
Yeah. I don't think we have enough research, kind of like what Marielle was saying with, we do cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy because of the research. I was reading an article that Jennifer Garner told her children that they could have social media once they came to her with articles saying that social media was beneficial for teenagers.
She's a genius.
Genius.
Yeah, I love that.
So yep.
Praise for Jennifer
using
Garner.
That.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm definitely going to use that. And to this day, I have no studies that show me that social media is positive for children. I have studies that show me that sports are positive for children. I have studies that show me that in-person school is positive for children to be interacting with others. Don't have the other stuff.
No. And my kids don't have it either, right? Mm-hmm. But they, you know, my daughter, you know, daughters, God bless them. They have a mother that's a therapist. But they talk about their friends who, you know, come to school and show them these things. And they say, Mom, that was really inappropriate. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know why she's doing that. I'm just freezing. Like, oh my gosh, like good. Something's sticking that I'm talking to you about.
Absolutely.
But to your point, Wendy, I have my 7-year-old and we have no technology windows of time at home.
I like that.
I take it away though. Right. When she earns it, take it away. Tantrum. Mm-hmm.
Same.
Full blown tantrum. So like, is it an addiction? Like what's happening there? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's the dopamine. There's dopamine theory of rewards. And basically every time that they do this, it's like a shot of dopamine. And it's hard for them to take it away. You know, you tell someone who's drank coffee for the last 20 years that you're going to take their coffee away.
Yeah,
they
no.
will lose it on right you. Exactly.
Loyal Starbucks
I will
member.
Lose it. I would lose it. And so you think about these kids who their whole life, a lot of them has been on the screen unregulated. And now all of a sudden you're saying you're going to take it away. Oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my eldest will have friends come over, mm-hmm. right? Sleepovers only at our house.
Mm-hmm. Like that.
Because of the world.
Yeah.
And I will go knock and see what they're doing. They're all on their iPads, mm-hmm. not socializing. So I see as a clinician, but also as a parent, mm-hmm. that our youth right now don't have social skills.
No.
Right? And so they are addressing this distress, this frustration, these issues in very impulsive, sometimes unfortunately dangerous, mm-hmm. right, ways because they haven't learned how to emotionally regulate, how mm-hmm. to deal with setbacks mm-hmm. and disappointments in an appropriate way. They don't know. It's more of, I expect something right away. I expect Amazon right. to bring me something right mm-hmm. away, Uber to bring me something right
That's
away, Google to give me information right away versus me with my Britannica encyclopedia, like looking up.
Exactly.
So I feel like we learned to be patient.
Yeah.
And weird question, right? Yeah. Stay with me, doctor, but
okay.
is there a neurochemistry? Is there a chemical connection related to impatience? Does that make sense?
Related to impatience, I wouldn't say like we particularly know like where impatience is in the brain. But I would say there's probably some overactivity. Like your amygdala is like the area of like fear, things like that. And oftentimes fear can, you know, push people into doing a lot of different things that maybe they wouldn't have done otherwise. So possibly that. But in particular, no.
Mm.
I want to take it back to the parents now.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to the parents?
Good question.
So I am a parent. I have a 10-month-old and a 4-year-old. And I find that it's so difficult myself to put down my phone. And so I would say that the first step is finding those windows of time where you, as the parent, can put down the phone and spend that quality time with your kids. That's the number one thing.
And like really put it down? Like truly.
Like I'm saying,
okay,
like,
I hear you.
Put it in the other room in a box, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an iWatch, it's still on you. You'll still know if something happens. It's scary.
That makes me nervous.
I know. I sometimes have to get phone calls, and if I miss them, bad things happen, basically. And so I got an iWatch for that purpose. But I have found that since I have it, it feels like a little part of my phone is with me. So I can put that down and know that I'm not leaving it or know that I'm not missing something. So I would say first, set times for yourself not to have the cell phone or whatever. And then try to come up with activities that you guys can do together. I always tell people that I'm a doer mom. I'm not like a sit there and play with you mom. I'm going to be honest. I can do that for about 10 to 15 minutes playing with a 4-year-old, but then my mind just starts going and I'm like, oh, I'm bored. I don't like this. And
thank you for saying that.
As much as I want to like play with my yes. kid, like, oh my gosh, I just can't sit there and play with him. I love him.
I think a lot of us feel that way.
I think a lot of parents feel that way and people are so scared to admit it. Like to say like, I don't love hanging out with my kid all the time. And guess what, guys? It's okay.
Yeah,
it is.
That's normal.
And yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah.
What about bullying? I know, mm-hmm. I work in an acute care facility as well as mm-hmm. residential. And I think that's probably one of the most common themes that I've noticed when I meet with some of our Absolutely. Residents is, and I was thinking that because we're talking about social media.
Absolutely.
Like, what do we do as parents to help with that? And how do we know when, hey, this is such a mm-hmm. serious issue or mm-hmm. my child is so depressed that I should probably seek more help?
Absolutely. So I would say that the first biggest thing is that if your kids have internet access, anything like that, you need to be monitoring it. There's different apps, there's different ways that you can do that, but you need to be seeing everything. As much as I would like to trust kids, don't trust them. I remember being a kid. I was not trustworthy. I just wasn't. And so I feel like what people really need to do is, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, no, it was, that's my fault because I asked about
bullying.
Three different
about
questions.
Bullying. Okay.
Bullying
I
kind of
lost it.
Knowing when yeah. like, hey, we need some additional help here or knowing
absolutely.
When like, this is a problem that maybe
just
not.
Flags.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely like monitoring their social media will be helpful. I actually dealt with someone recently who was the bully and not the bullier. or not the bullied. And so that was interesting too, because that person figured it out because their parents were monitoring and saw that this kid was threatening other people, you know? So it's important to monitor that. It's important to also have your kids recognize that they have a voice and they can stand up for themselves. And also that bullying should not be tolerated no matter what. It doesn't matter if they threaten you. It doesn't matter what they say. You need to tell an adult. That's the most important thing.
One of the things that I experienced was a really uncomfortable thing that I had found on my older daughter's phone. And I almost like therapized myself in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I need to make sure she doesn't connect vulnerability and honesty with shame and blame and punishment. Ooh. Right.
Yeah. Say that again, because that was
yes. Oh, I'm getting chills thinking about it. I think it was more, it's right now one of the most powerful moments I've had with my daughter. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm gonna get emotional.
Yeah.
So I find this thing and I freak out because I hear worst of the worst, but I didn't want her to connect vulnerability and honesty and transparency with me shaming, blaming, and punishing. So I told her, hey, I'm not mad. I found something. It makes me nervous and scared, but you're not in trouble. I just want to know what happened, if something's happening, and I just need to understand. And I want you to know that you can ask me anything about anything, anytime. And it was a really great introduction into boundaries and curiosity and, you know, puberty and all these things that I wanted to avoid as long as I could until she was 55.
Right.
But then I wrapped up that conversation with her saying, I hope that you notice how mom wasn't yelling, right, how mom wasn't judging you, how mom wasn't interrupting you. I was just listening and here for you. And I want you to know that anything that might feel scary, you can come talk to me. And I think that was the best thing I could have done because I'm Puerto Rican and wanted to freak out on her. Yeah. but since then, she's like, Mom, look at what they said to me. Is that okay?
Yeah. You've created this bond with her and she knows I can trust you. You're a safe person.
Yeah.
And that's what all these kids need, because picture it the other way. You went in there accusatory saying, what is this? Why am I seeing this? What's going on? You're in trouble, this and that. She never would have come to you again.
Mm-mm. No.
And I think a lot of people come from the generation of, you know, let's punish you. Let's take something away. Let's do something. Not let's hear it out.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that, you know, as parents, we have to be soft either. Some of the parents that I do therapy with confuse validation for, what's the word I want to think of?
Passive.
As being permission. Passive. Yeah. Or giving permission or, you know, allowing it to occur. And I say to them, you can understand the thought process your child was going through at the time and still completely disagree with the decision making and offer a boundary, a consequence, right? Yeah. I can understand why you did that, what you did, but it can't happen.
Right.
Right. And I wonder if sometimes as parents, we think that not being really firm and clear will lead to saying, you know, basically you have permission to do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think parenting is a constant, and I think all of us are parents. It's constantly like, am I doing this right? Like, am I going to mess up my kids? And that's constantly what I think. And I think you just have to parent with thinking like, I want to do what's best for my kid, but I also want them to know what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like my son the other day, I was having to dictate my notes, which means like talking into the phone, and he's screaming in the back and I'm yelling at him and I'm just like totally losing it. And I was not in control of myself then. Mm-hmm. And I like could have used a coping skill or two. But the whole thing is that even when we get dysregulated, you can still say to your kid, hey, this is really important to mommy. And that's why I sat him down and I said, hey, I have to do this. I don't want to do this. This is what mommy has to do for my job. And I always say to him, mommy goes to work so Jonah can play. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I sat him down. I explained it. I calmed myself down. And I said, hey, you do this for the next 10 minutes. And after that, we're going to go to Jeremiah's if you can do that. And he was able to, and that's what we did. And so I like rewards and stuff, but I also take things away too. You know, he's being a brat about something. I'm saying, no, you're not going to play with this until tomorrow. But I also know for myself, like, it's hard for me to put my kid in timeout. It just is. That's just not how I do it. But there's other ways to go about it. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone needs to recognize that, like, parenting can be whatever you make it. But I think you need to keep your kid's best interest at heart and also don't discourage them. I think that's the biggest thing, is that parents, we can get so up in our own anxiety that we then take it out on our kids. Our fear gets taken out on them. Oh my God, you sent a nude picture to someone? What are you thinking? What's going on? Like, I am going to freak out. I'm going to call the police. I'm going to do all of these things. When in reality, you need to take a step back and say, hey, I need to understand what is going on with my kid. Mm-hmm. And if I have any chance of getting this kid to talk to me, yeah, I need to go in there calm.
So what advice would you give to parents on how to talk to their kids?
I would say start off with something that you have in common or something that you enjoy or that you want to hear about. Oftentimes, I don't think kids want to come home from school and then tell you exactly like how their day was. It's maybe you should start off with saying like, hey, like, you know, I was thinking we should be going on a vacation soon. Like, what's somewhere that you would want to go? Or, you know, start off with just like something different. And then like once they feel comfortable with you, or once you're comfortable in that setting, say, you know, hey, I found something and I'm concerned. You're not in trouble, but can we talk about this? Don't even say can't. We're going to talk about this.
Mm. I kind of like what you both said too. And it made me think of a time with my son where he likes it when I tell him about the times when I was young and I made bad decisions. He's like, you really did that, mommy? So like, it's okay for parents, I think, to be human too. Oh, yeah. And I think for your kids to see you in those moments where maybe you lost your cool. Absolutely. And like, how did you handle it? Because they're going to look at what you're doing. Yeah. And those are the things they're probably going to mirror, regardless of what you said and told them how to react to a situation or mm-hmm. how to deal with something. But they're always looking at us. Like, that the works. Things my kid remembers, like, how did you remember that?
Yeah.
Oh, I saw you do this, mommy, or I saw you do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's wild what they pick up on.
Yeah.
It really is.
And I think it's important too is, like, if we mess up, to be honest and say, hey,
absolutely. And I said that to him. I said, you know, mommy lost my cool. I'm really sorry about that. I should have done something different. And I actually asked him, I go, what do you think mommy should have done? And it's cute. I like Daniel Tiger. And he said, you should take a deep breath and count to four. And so I'm like, I did it. Like, he remembers this. Yeah. Getting him to do it is another thing. But at least he knows what Daniel Tiger does.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Gabe.
Yeah.
You know, room full of women, mothers. Yeah. As a dad, what is it like for you? What do you feel like right now? I don't know maybe where the specific question is, but I'm thinking of just expectations for fathers, especially now, and how you approach this conversation of validation and essentially like emotional intelligence and parenting as a father.
As a father, for me, it's kind of different because I never had a father figure. So I'm kind of, it's all this is new to me.
Yeah.
All I know is that I love my daughter very much.
Yeah.
And, you know, I make mistakes along the way, but maybe 90% of the time, like I'm doing what's right for her. Well, 100% of the time I'm doing what's right for her, but maybe 90% of the time I'm doing it the right way. But just, you know, I have a beautiful wife that supports me and, you know, recently married.
Yeah. Congratulations.
And, you know, having her, you know, bounce ideas off me and you know, we parent together. I think it's looking at the support that I have helps. And just, you know, there's something like instinctive about like doing what's right. And I'm blessed with my daughter. She's amazing. She's, you know, sweet. She'll always offer you the last of everything and, you know.
Yeah. And I did want to bring up also that, like you said, your daughter is great and that's wonderful. I want to address the parents whose kids don't always behave, you know, because that can be really tough. It can be really tough to have negative feelings toward your own kid. Mm-hmm. And often we have a lot of parents come into us who say, my kid is acting out and I feel this way about them and I feel so guilty about it. And I don't know what to do about that. And so, you know, that's an interesting thing to deal with because you never growing up think, am I not going to like my kid? And how do you deal with that? And it's about building the relationship back. And that's what our therapists do so well at La Amistad is they really can take the situation and they first meet with the parents individually. And then they meet with the kids, and then they come together. And it's that kind of situation that I think creates the best results to get everyone to be working better as a team.
Do you have moments where, like, you have that connection where you're just like, oh man, they just, like, you can see it happening in the room in therapy or when you're meeting with the families? What's that like? Or does it not happen as often as you would like?
In terms of like a happy reunion or like
along the lines of, you know, you have a kid who is going through some stuff, you're bringing them in for family therapy, and here we are, here's mom, here's dad, here's the kid, we're doing it, we're in residential treatment. How are you going to fix us? And like, do you have aha moments? Do you have like, do you see it click at some point? What does that look like?
I think
more of a long process.
It's a long process for sure. And I think that it looks different for the therapist and the psychiatrist.
Yeah, oh, interesting.
It absolutely does.
How is it different? I'm curious.
I think for me, I'm looking a lot at acute safety concerns. And I'm also looking at mood instability, irritability, things like that. What the therapist is looking for is their interactions with other people. That sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know, I would say that when it comes to the doctor's side, what I hear is, okay, doctor, like I can manage this, right? Or sometimes it's getting a family to agree that we're beyond the point of therapy being effective, and they need to trust that the doctor knows what she's doing and that medications are needed to give the child relief, right? These children are really dysregulated. Their emotions are like a roller coaster. It's miserable feeling out of control. And like you don't know how or can manage yourself, right? And so I tell families, they could do it. It would take a lot of time and effort. And also it shouldn't be this hard. Right. For a little body, it shouldn't be this hard. And so medication wise, and then for clinically, I think for me, it's those moments of secure attachment. And that's something that's more of a buzzword lately, thankfully, right? Not until the 1980s, I think, that was there a government initiative up in Washington for really looking at developmental trauma and attachment trauma recently. 1980s, 1990s. So it's the moments where a family feels safe enough to share not only good, but bad moments, right? A parent being vulnerable and secure enough to not dysregulate, because she was saying, knowing this is not about me, let me just be here for my child. And
let me validate my child, which can be very difficult for a lot of parents.
Yeah. And then a child being honest, and transversely, a parent getting that aha of how to communicate effectively, and then a teenager saying, okay, my parents are flawed too, and it's okay. They're not superheroes. And the world is not just revolving around me. I think I'm going to hurt them. Let me be here to listen and validate my parents. Yeah, dad, I'm sorry. That was a awful thing to say to you. You must have been really scared when I ran away. Requires trust. You have to trust someone. Yeah.
And it's not just all of a sudden, like, I'm going to send my kid away and they're going to come back chipper and ready to go. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Is what you're saying.
And I think parents, like, there's a certain point of the kids that get to us. So I know that you had asked about, like, at what point do you take someone to get more help?
Yeah.
I think what you really want to do is, like, if your kid is struggling, I would first, you know, look for resources either in your neighborhood or your friends, or sometimes online. Like, there's a website called NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, that's absolutely wonderful, has tons of resources. That's a really good place to start if you don't know where you're going. But I think the thing that you need to keep an eye on is my kid struggling and are they functioning? So if they are not functioning well, so like they're not showering, they're not brushing their teeth, they're not eating, they're not doing their schoolwork, they're not, you know, doing those things. Are they putting themselves at risk of something? Are they cutting? Are they saying they're suicidal? Those kids absolutely need to be seen. I would say for the majority of kids with just maybe like a little bit of social anxiety or a little bit of something, the best bet is to start off with your pediatrician. Ask your pediatrician, hey, is this something I need to be worried about? Because that this is their bread and butter. They should know when they need to refer out.
It's a good piece of advice.
Yeah. And I also think it's important for parents to do their own therapy,
mm-hmm.
right? Simultaneously, because we're individuals Absolutely. Too. We have yeah. our own stuff. And you never know what is left over unfinished business until you are reminded of it, oh, you know?
Yes.
It's like, I thought I was over that, or I thought that was not a thing. And now it's popping up. Oh, now, you know, my daughter's 7 and she's talking back.
Exactly.
So, you know, they kind of, you know, sometimes the environment in life reminds us that we still have our own work to do. And
absolutely.
Yeah, that only enhances the, you know, the experience of the children as well in treatment.
That reminds me of a term I've been hearing a lot about is generational trauma.
Yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So you can consider it in two different ways. You can consider it when it comes to that language of, I have a toxic family, right? All of us are messed up, that kind of language. Oh yeah, my grandma was like that. My uncle was like that. My sister's like that. And then you look at it genetically, right? Epigenetics is the term. And that is the concept that we all have DNA, right? We all, 80% of our personality is genetic, by the way. 20% is something that can be expressed after the fact, right? And that's where the environmental influences come in. But also genetically, in epigenetics, we're looking at the transformation and the influence that exposure to trauma and stress can have in at the molecular level, right? So if my great-great-great-great-grandpa was in some kind of natural disaster and his, you know, his generations afterwards were as well, mm-hmm. all that extra stress hormone is going to affect mm-hmm. all the neurochemistry in my, in their brain. Yeah. yeah. And then, yeah.
Yeah. If you want to think about it, like as a more recent thing, like you can think about Holocaust survivors.
Right.
That's been a big population that has been studied in terms of the generational mm-hmm. trauma. Mm-hmm. And you think about it. So these were individuals who survived the Holocaust. They come out, they have children. They're probably going to treat their children differently being a survivor of this level of trauma.
100%.
And so you have to think that epigenetically, so there's DNA influences based on the stress that this person was having when they were like at a concentration camp
yeah.
or whatever. And then you take that out. Now they're having babies. They're doing all of this. And now there's this entire population whose parents were persecuted. How are you supposed to live like that? And then you have grandkids and they're experiencing the same thing. So it's about breaking that cycle.
Yeah. I was doing some research on this a couple of months ago, and there was an analogy. They were saying it's like your brain is formulated to still think that there's dinosaurs, but there's not.
Oh, interesting.
Like it doesn't develop, right? Or evolve. And yeah. so if there's all this stress, right, we are born already with this genetic impression that the world is dangerous
mm-hmm.
because my survived. Ancestors, you know, went through dangerous things, but it doesn't like evolve out.
Wow.
Because it's happening genetically.
And that's basically what an anxiety disorder is.
Yeah.
It's they used to say that anxiety disorders kind of came about historically because you needed to have fear of whatever is chasing you. So you needed that fight or flight response. And so as time has gone on, we've gotten, you know, calmer as a society, but the anxiety has still stayed.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that triggered a thought. We're talking about kids a little bit ago, and I'm having a lot of experiences with families saying they're not nervous about the future. They don't care mm-hmm. to like figure out who they are, what they want to do. And as far as like anthropology and culture, they're right. Mm-hmm. What do they need to be afraid of?
Not
I can
much.
Order food and stay home literally all day. I don't
you
have to leave my house.
From
yeah, I don't have to leave my house. So I can have friends online. I can look,
yes.
I can talk to them
right.
on video. I don't have to leave my house. Mom and dad, you're right. They're not in a rush to leave the warm, cozy cave. Everything's given to them. So, you know, and then there's the anxiety because it's like, oh my God, my parents are pressuring me and pushing me out and I have mm-hmm. to grow up and I don't know how to manage or tolerate. And this is really, really, really scary. And we have this wave of like 19, 18, 20, 21 year olds who go back home when they graduate or they're still in high school. And they're like, I don't know. I don't think I want to go to a state school or move out. I'm going to live here and go to a local community college and just chill. Because
yeah.
why not? Because there's no fear right now. There's no urgency to survive. We're comfortable.
So what's something that gives you hope?
My kids.
Your kids.
Yeah. They give me hope. I think about them a lot, but they give me hope, but they also give me fear. You know, yeah. It's the double-edged sword of being a parent. I am hopeful that there will be more research into mental health. I'm hopeful that the stigma is really decreasing. It's becoming less and less that I have people come in when I ask them like family history, where they say, oh, my family doesn't talk about that. Because that used to be pretty common, especially in certain cultures. They're like, oh, no, that was never discussed. We have no idea. Now people are more open about it. They know, oh, my grandma had this, so-and-so had that, so-and-so committed suicide, whatever. And I think having an open conversation, that gives me hope. I think positive things are on the horizon, but I think we live in scary times. And hopefully that'll get better.
What about you? Gives you hope?
Ooh, I think the future, things that are to come, goals, laughter gives me hope.
Yes.
Knowing that tomorrow's going to be better sounds cheesy.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Wendy?
Me? I don't know. You're going to ask me. I would say, you know, we talked a lot about like an isolating culture and how we can kind of just get everything we could possibly get from our couches. And as grim as that kind of seems, there's always the beauty of human connection.
Yeah.
That it could be a smile from someone across the room. It could be an embrace by the person you love. Like, that to me gives me hope in our human race with myself. I think that's really important, and I don't think that's going to go away.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Yeah, I think this right here is something that gives me hope because, you know, we're having a discussion about mental health.
Yeah.
I like it. We're normalizing it, you know. It's not a 1 in 5, it's a 5 in 5, right? We've all had our challenges, our bad days, you know, we've all overcome, you know, because we're sitting here. I think just kind of, you know, the fact that we're doing this, more people are seeking help. You know, we're in a position to help people too, with all our jobs. I think that gives me hope.
Absolutely.
And
Well, it's been such a nice time sharing with Dr. Weiss.
This has been wonderful. Thank you.
And Marielle and Gabe.
I'm going to be here.
For all those that are listening, if you are struggling with anxiety, depression, any kind of mental health substance use issue, please seek help. 988 is a number that you can call, that you can get help anywhere. You can also reach out to any of our facilities here in Central Florida. We have Palm Point in Titusville, Central Florida, over by SeaWorld, University Behavioral Center over by UCF. And of course, La Amistad, where Dr. Weiss is a physician and Marielle is a counselor. We provide residential levels of care for adults as well as for kiddos 11 and up. And then we also have some intensive outpatient programs as well. Regardless of where you get help, definitely seek it out. It's worth it. And we're so happy to be here with you today. And we look forward to seeing you on our next podcast.